Hello and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, the pop culture podcast for everyone whose floorboards are groaning under the weight of legacy media. My name's Andrew Harrison, and up for examination this week we've got The Disaster Artist, director James Franco's dramatisation of the true story behind a low-budget release from the early noughties called The Room, famously acclaimed as the worst movie ever made. Franco plays the deeply peculiar writer-director Tommy Wiseau, who shoots an apparently plotless, directionless Hollywood picture in an endless shoot, yet seems to have bottomless resources to call on. So bad that it's at least weirdly enjoyable, The Room becomes a cult hit, but is The Disaster Artist as enjoyable? We'll also be looking at Power to the People, British music video, 1966 to 2016, a vast and scholarly collection of the possibly dying art of the music video. But mainly, we'll be talking to our special guests, one of whom is legendary music writer and contributing editor to US GQ magazine, Chris Heath. Chris cut his teeth on smash hits back in the glory days of Lord Frederick of Lucan and Back, and inverted commas around everything. With his two Pet Shop Boys books, Literally and Pet Shop Boys vs. America, he refined a new way of writing about pop stars. Don't retell the story, record the minutiae and let the subject paint an accidental and sometimes unflattering picture of themselves. When he applied it to Robbie Williams, the result was the best-selling Feel, and now a new one, Reveal, in which Chris shadows the complicated pop star through a decade-long personal crisis. It's one of those rare books where you don't have to like the subject's music in order to enjoy the book. Hello, Chris, and welcome to Big Mouth. How are you?
I am good.
Jolly good. How long does it take to get a pop star to fool themselves that you're not actually really there, that you're just kind of an invisible presence?
You know, I actually think that it takes an amazingly short amount of time. Mm-hmm. It's weird, but I mean, you see that even with people who are followed around by camera crews. A huge amount of reality TV is based upon the fact that people think they can mediate their behavior when they've got people watching them. And you can only, it's like holding your breath. You can only keep it going for, I mean, you can't hold your breath for a few hours, but you can only keep going, not changing your behavior every second for a few hours, I think. And then you get used to someone being around.
Is it because certain pop stars think about themselves all the time anyway?
I don't think so. I think that aspect of it would be the same with all kinds of different pop stars. I just I'm trying to wonder what your question really meant.
Well, no, I mean, Robbie Williams is completely over about the fact that he is a narcissistic egomaniac and a psychological kind of area of interest, and that's part of his appeal, is that he simply doesn't care that you know this.
He doesn't care is a weird phrasing. Mm. He doesn't mind that you know that is one part of his, that describes some aspects of his personality. Mm. It's far from all he is or the whole of what he is at all. And I hope that, the books that I've written show that. But he's comfortable having someone he trusts around because, he is more interested than most people are who are that famous and in that kind of situation. He kind of has the impulse that I think as journalists we admire that if you're going to have something written about you, it might as well be true. That's going to be more interesting.
There's a great bit in the book where he sits there ranting at other people's interviews on the telly and how dull and scripted they are.
This is a big impulse of his. You know, he gets infuriated by, as the word he usually uses is, these vanilla interviews people do. Because we live in an era where a huge number, especially of the most famous celebrities, go on different kinds of media and they're deliberately uninteresting. They're trying to be uninteresting. They often have training to help them be uninteresting. And, I think I recently described it, but, I think that Rob thinks that's like a sort of sin against the gods of entertainment. Yeah. It's like, if you're going to do this, he's got a very old-fashioned view in that way. You're supposed to entertain people with all this stuff. And if you don't, why not just be quiet?
Yeah, he might have even written a song about it, mightn't he? We should meet our other guest as well today. She is an illustrator of children's books, a pop fiend, a David Bowie and Pet Shop Boys obsessive. Her latest book is The Cow Who Fell to Earth, featuring a space bovine with a black star on her chest. It's Nadia Shereen. Hello and welcome to Big Mouth, Nadia.
Hi, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm feeling a bit embarrassed at that description of me.
I think it's pretty good. Actually, I mean, anybody else written a book about a David Bowie in the form of a cow?
Not yet, but
now the idea's out.
Yeah, right. How much Bowie is in the cow?
There's really not any, but it's really not, because that's just that would just be really indulgent and awful. The title and the black star are kind of a cheeky little nod just to please myself, but otherwise it's a picture book about a cow who lands in a field full of sheep, and it's actually about language.
It's about language,
that kind of stuff.
It's about how the cow and the sheep relate.
It's about a cow not being understood by these sheep, and the sheep have a stranger in their midst and they can't communicate and the sheep have to help the cow somehow.
There we go.
Allegory.
Yes. And you are a noted pop fiend, and I believe you were reading Smash Hits when Chris was there.
Yeah. I was a huge Smash Hits fan. I mean, people ask me now, because I write picture books as well as illustrate them, and people say, oh, what picture books did you read when you were growing up and that influenced how you write? And I'm like, well, I'm not really sure I can tell you what picture books influenced me, but I can tell you that Smash Hits influenced me so much so that I read it cover to cover. And when I was in my early 20s and I moved down to London, a job came up at Smash Hits for a sub-editor. And I was working on a different mag at the time. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go. Went to the job interview. And I took with me, and I have the prop here. I took with
me rustling, listeners,
a copy of Smash Hits that I kept since 1987 that had a life-changing feature on the cover and inside where Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys goes back to Smash Hits to become editor for the day. And I can't look at it. I've got a copy here.
It's in really good nick, actually. That's really good nick.
Good nick. And I took this in with me to my job interview. Yes. And I think they said, wow, you're demented. You're hired.
So this is basically the Alan Partridge room, the portrait of Alan Partridge room that you took into a job interview.
Basically, they were like, oh my God, if we don't hire her, we have to call the police.
Yes. So, did Chris write that one?
Chris wrote this.
Oh, Chris. Do you remember that one?
Oh, absolutely.
I remember great it really times.
Well. Yeah, so, no. I mean, I haven't looked at this for a while, but even I can remember tinkering with the flat plan. And I went on to become production editor at Smash Hits. Yeah. And I tell you what, every time I tinkered with that flat plan, in my head I was tinkering with the flat plan.
I like the ongoing conceit in Smash Hits that Pet Shop Boys was just a silly little jeu d'esprit for Neil. And he'd come crawling back for a proper job one of these days, probably on a reduced salary, actually, as punishment for leaving.
But the funny thing is, you know, the initial thing that set that off was a thing that Tom Hibbert wrote in Bits when Neil left. And I don't know that Tom was being completely, you know, completely humorful and ironic.
You know,
because Tom had a fantastic sense of humor, but a fairly jaded view of the world. And so I thought there was always a bit of an edge in what Tom wrote.
Well, we were returning to the world of Jumbo Brilliant and Swingo Brilliant and Black Type T-Tales very shortly, but we should quickly say hello as well to the man who keeps Big Mouth, both Jumbo Brilliant and Swingo Brilliant, our producer, the Black Type T-Tales podcast, Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Did you know anybody who ever had a Black Type T-Tale?
No, my Smash Hits period was pre, I think, Chris. And oh my God, I would
produce the bloody
point.
Black Type tea towel.
Wow. I bought two. I'm
Nadia,
really sorry, and Andrew can fight it.
Nadia has a Black Type tea towel.
I'm now getting slightly worried at being.
Thank you
being,
so much. That's really.
Please
kind.
Don't panic. Please don't panic. Or call the police. I'm brought
in two Black Type tea. We're locked in a basement in a Soho with a woman that I'm ever so slightly getting kind of worried about. I'm glad there's a table between us.
This is actually going full Partridge. Okay. Before we get rolling, before we run out of the studio, before we run away from Nadia screaming, you're a mentalist, let's have a little bit of housekeeping, listeners. If you like Big Mouth, you might want to subscribe via Apple Podcasts and leave us a review and a star rating while you're there. It all helps get the show noticed and it generally appeases the godlike iTunes algorithm. If you're an Apple refusenik, don't worry. We are available on your favourite podcast apps, including Spotify. And so is our sister show, Remaniacs, the No Bullshit Brexit podcast, which you might also enjoy. Okay, let's get back to Reveal, Chris Heath's observational memoir or text-driven biopic or fly-on-the-page book. Whatever it is, it's a close-up look of one of the most confused and confusing pop stars around. The book covers a 13-year period in which Robbie Williams drives himself to exhaustion and into rehab, gets married, has a kid, endures several crises of confidence, and somehow comes up smiling. To get you in the mood, here's something from the upswing towards the end of the tale from last year's album, The Heavy Entertainment Show. This is Party Like a Russian.
Dance like you got concussion, oh. We got soul and we got gold.
Robbie Williams with Party Like a Russian, with the uncommon writing credit Robbie Williams, Guy Chambers, Sergei Prokofiev, Chris Heath. So you and Sergei
did Prokofiev's people insist that you came after him?
Sergei and I did a lot together back in the
just kicking some licks around, throw it to Chambers to sort it out. Can you do something with this guy? A few ideas, mate. I met him when the album came out, and he said he'd never heard of Prokofiev. He thought it was the theme tune to The Apprentice. Quite rightly so.
You know that. Did he really say that to
he
you?
He did say that.
See, that is such,
I bet he said that to everybody, didn't
that
he?
That is such a Rob thing to say, because he knows exactly where that comes from.
Of course he does.
And so he's just trying to be the kind of worst version that you'd expect and see if people realise he's joking.
There's a lovely bit in the book where somebody from the label is talking about how there's some momentum behind the new album. And it says that there's some real wind behind this album. And Robbie announces, "I'm Robbie Williams and I've got wind." And that just seems to be him all over. What is the key Heath moment in the Robbie Williams oeuvre, now that you're adding lyrics and helping, and which you've been doing for some time, haven't you?
I feel like it's a very different part of everything than writing about him. But it's just something that happens occasionally. I wouldn't be so bold as to identify any key moments.
He did say that the reviews have started to say Williams has become more articulate, and he said it's all because of Chris. It's all Chris's fault. More self-hating kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd put that again with the Prokofiev comment.
Yes, obviously. Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about, one of the numerous interesting things in Reveal is that there's a great moment where Trevor Horn says, "What hours do you like to do in the studio?" And he says, "Friday." Which is both a joke and not a joke, because as you point out, so much of the work has already been done by him. He does produce extremely finished demos and extremely finished work.
That's the thing, is he'll say that joke, and he would say that, I would sort of wince when he'd say that later in press interviews, because it makes it sound like he's the kind of caricature of a kind of pop star who's only vaguely involved in his own music, whereas he's so fantastically the opposite of that. And it's funny when he says it, but it frustrates me. And in this case, these were songs he'd written and produced with his friends in his studio over 2 years. And obviously Trevor did great things to them, but the songs and the arrangements were already there.
I mean, I think that's the reason that I find him, out of all the current crop of pop stars, or the pop stars of the last kind of decade, he's kind of the most interesting to me, because he operates on a whole load of levels. This kind of gormless, cheeky chappy who's there more out of luck than judgment, and yet, you know, the lyrics in something like Party Like a Russian has got so many kind of references, and there's so many allusions, and there's so much modern kind of current affairs stuff worked in there, and he can deliver that on stage at the Brits or whatever, you know, with a completely straight face. Or kind of, there are so many different sides to him that I find him an incredibly intriguing character.
Yeah, and obviously I find, and I hope other people will find, that is incredibly fascinating, and that much more complicated and interesting than most people are these days. Of course, the danger you have being like that, which definitely you see plenty in the book of happening, is that it's very easy, particularly in the era of social media, for people to very deliberately take one aspect of that and to just hammer it as if that's that's a perfect sort of male long line piece. Idiot Robbie Williams doesn't know that his song isn't just a theme tune from a TV show.
Yeah.
You know, and that happens weekly.
So is his most difficult job almost to kind of keep all the, you know, like a plate spinner, to keep all the different facets of his personality on view to all the different people that want to see that?
I don't think he plans any of that. I think that's his instinct, and I think fundamentally it's just who he is. But it's also, if it's anything beyond that, it's going back to what we were saying. He doesn't want to be boring. He wants to be entertaining. He wants to be interesting, and that keeps it interesting, I think, both for himself and for other people, if he's doing all of those different things. Because he's not, he's not like someone who's like, you know, the pop stuff isn't real and it's really awesome grand art project. You know, it's all of these things. You know, he's totally, I mean, he gets really offended when someone thinks he's not serious about, you know, the most fundamental level of wanting to entertain in the most mass media way. That's absolutely part of him too.
He's also incredibly defensive about pop, isn't he? There's a bit where Brett Anderson, whom I love, and I think Suede are fantastic, but Brett Anderson made some, you know, fairly kind of basic comments about the crapness of pop and the naftas and disposability of pop. And Robbie Williams writes this lengthy, angry blog post, which he subsequently feels embarrassed about. defending not his own work, but pop in general.
Yeah,
pop is what it's all about. But unfortunately, he then goes and slags off pretty much every indie band going, even the ones that he likes and even the ones that like him.
And you know, it got a bit out of hand, the way he reacted there. But fundamentally, as you see later on, because this plays itself out over quite a period of time in the book, you realise, which is what I think the truth is that what he was reacting to when he wrote that blog wasn't some really quite anodyne thing that Brett had possibly even been misquoted about in The Sun about One Direction. What he was reacting to was 15 years of prime Britpop era on either side of that, of enemyism, of the way that pop music was treated in the world that we were all in different parts of, and just that sort of instinctive contempt where someone like, and I don't even know if Brett would be the best example, but it was totally normal for someone in a band like that to say to a journalist or on the radio something just incredibly disparaging about the worthlessness of pop music, and everyone would nod. It was just the language and the accepted thing, and that's what he was reacting against, because that annoyed him for all that time.
Yeah. But your model of writing is... which you apply not just to pop stars, but to the great and the good of politics, sports, and current affairs. In fact, you know, you write about celebrity and fame more than anything else. It's surprising to me that more people don't try to do it, because you record more simply by observing and you know, placing the activities and the ticks and the little asides more than you do by sitting down and looking someone in the eye and asking them to explain their art.
Yeah, I don't... I don't know if I'm glad or not glad that more people don't do it like that, but I mean, I would say, I'm just about to say without blowing my own trumpet, which obviously meant I was about to.
You are plugging a book, Chris.
I guess, but you know, it's not that easy. You know, it requires an incredible amount of work. I mean, I'm now going into blowing my trumpet mode, but you know, for this book, I had 70 huge notebooks full of notes, and literally, if I told you how many thousands of hours of recordings, you would go a bit weird. Mm. So it's just how I got used to working, and how that's what I like to do. That's what I think the thing I do is. It involves taking as long as possible. So, you know. I think some people would try and do this kind of thing halfway, where they would sort of spend a bit of time with someone and get some details.
Yeah,
and
colour, yes.
And throw in a story with... It's not about that. It's more like sort of how someone would make a documentary film, where most of what you would film is going to end up on the cutting room floor. It's not finding any moments of sort of incidentalness. It's the very precise ones. You know, you know, there are only incidental moments in the same way that someone making a cup of tea in a novel is incidental. You know, everything that happens in a novel, if it's a great novel, is in some indirect way towards the greater purpose of the story you're trying to tell, whether it's pulling you away from that or pulling you back to that or all kinds of millions of other things. That's what I want to be doing. Now, people will have to judge whether I succeed or not, but that's the conceit.
So when you're sitting in Robbie Williams' front room in Los Angeles watching him watch last night's reality TV and get embarrassed about something that he once said to Darren Day about somebody they mutually shagged, is there a voice at the back of your mind going, this bit's gold, this is gold, this bit, don't forget this bit?
A little bit, to be honest. You know, spending time with Rob, there's a lot of gold. Mm. You know, the pan is quite often quite full.
Yes.
So you know, you don't feel that quite as much as you would, maybe with someone else. Mm. But yeah, there's definitely bits where you're kind of, I'm suddenly very acutely aware this is a keeper. There's, you know, I'm always in my notebook. I have various different kind of annotations. And basically, if you look through my notebooks, every now and again, there'll be double lines along the left-hand side next to something. And that means this bit's really good. Find every bit of recording.
Do you, because I mean, you kind of honed this on the two Pet Shop Boys books, literally, and Pet Shop Boys versus America, which I believe the first one you kind of wrote without their permission because they thought you were just going to write captions for a photo book.
Yeah, I think our memories are at this juncture all slightly different about this, but my memory of it is that, you know, they were doing their first ever tour and they were going to Hong Kong and Japan and then playing in Britain. And back then, in those days, artists normally took a photographer on tour with them. There was a tour photographer. And I think they just thought it was a weird idea. Why don't we have a tour writer?
Roger in Residence.
So you know, Pet Shop Boys.
It is very Pet Shop Boys.
And you know, and it was a very big instinct of them. I mean, obviously, it's been an instinct throughout their career. But that instinct of we don't want to do what everyone else does was a very strong sort of force in them. And I think this was sort of inspired by that kind of thinking. And then we didn't really talk about what I would do. I think the idea was maybe some kind of photo book. It wasn't really, certainly we didn't really work out. And I don't know if they thought I was interested or was able to do the kind of thing that I did. But I saw it as this is an incredible opportunity to do the kind of reporting and the kind of writing that I've been trying to do and been trying to do more and more, but it was hard to do in magazines in England. Yeah. And I just thought, let's try.
Yeah. Nadia, you're a Pet Shop Boys nurse. Have you read Chris's Pet Shop Boys books?
What, you mean?
Oh, she's brought a bloody copy in, wrapped in a tea towel.
Do you mean literally?
She's got the hardback.
Which I got for my birthday.
Oh wow!
Did
you quite enjoy it then?
It was one of my favourite books. Yeah, as I say, it was a huge influence.
Was it the Pet Shop Boys books that brought Robbie to want to do this project? Did it want to do Feel in the first place? Because he's actually a Pet Shop Boys,
Yes, he's certainly a big fan of theirs. We'd ran into each other a few times, and then I'd written about Take That. We didn't really get to know each other there. Then I did a cover story for The Face when his second album came out. And it was around that time he'd read one of the Pet Shop Boys books. And I think it put in his head, maybe this guy'd be interested in doing that kind of thing about me. And then that idea sort of floated in and out of conversations. We kept running into each other in weird circumstances, quite by chance, which was, you know, and it kept sort of floating in and out. But I also think it helped a lot when I did start working on Feel, because it sort of set up a kind of idea. It made me feel like he understood the kind of thing that I was interested in doing and would probably do, and made me feel much more comfortable that he would be good with it.
This is quite confusing, if I can get this right. Last night, on Twitter, John Niven, friend of the pod, tweeted the section in the new book about Robbie Williams where Robbie Williams reads a section of John Niven's novel, Kill Your Friends, which is about Robbie Williams at the Brits. The one word comment that Niven makes is just oof, because it's kind of quite complex and meta and also quite sad, because the section that in Kill Your Friends is about Robbie clean at the Brits and looking like
and bored out of his mind.
He's realised that he's never going to be able to take drugs or anything ever again. And in your book, Chris, Robbie doesn't want to read or reads that bit and then doesn't want to read anymore because it's really depressing.
It's a devastating and slightly cruel portrait that John Niven produces. But you
who'd have thought that the Niven?
I wonder, right?
That. But yeah. I wonder if I bet that when Niven was writing it, he never. I'm sure he wasn't thinking at some point Robbie is going to see this.
I imagine not. And it's not, you know, it's not like it's perfectly accurate, but, you know, but Rob's reaction wasn't like, how dare you write this? It was much more like, wow, some of that's closer.
That nailed me. Yeah.
That's closer than is comfortable to read.
Mm. You've now spent something like 15 years with this extremely singular individual.
I've had days off.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you've also lived in his house for a while.
Now and again.
Does it make a nice cup of tea?
I don't think if he's ever made tea. He makes coffee.
Right.
Obviously,
you know, reading the books, you do understand what a very, very uncommon person this is to become a pop star. People like this who are willing to let it all hang out in a way that most people would pay money to suppress it are very rare in pop, let alone anywhere else. Has it given you any kind of further insight into why people love him so much? Because they really do. People like him who don't often like his music, for instance.
Well, I mean, before trying to answer that, of course, we have to. There's no point pretending the converse isn't true. Mm. You know, there are some people who dislike him with a sort of fever that is quite unusual, and I think it's part of the same thing. But I think there's a few reasons why people like him, but you know, and some of them are the very simple ones. People, you know, like the way he sings and the songs he sings and, mm-hmm. and the kind of things they communicate. And without that, the rest of it, I don't think would happen. But I think people do sense a kind of realness about him, and I think there's also another thing. They sort of there's a sort of sense, and I know, and he, you know, even though he's this sort of incredibly rich person who lives quite an isolated life a lot of the time, there's a sense I think people have that he's one of us.
Mm.
And I don't think they're wrong about that, you know, even though, you know, he's not claiming anything. He knows how different his life is in all kinds of ways. But in some sense, I think he had, amongst the otherness, there's a sort of fellowness about him that a lot of people in his position don't have.
My favourite Robbie Williams moment of recent years is when he did the New Year's Eve gig in London and very theatrically shook the hands of the front row and then got out the hand sanitizer and slightly conspicuously rubbed hands, not making a big thing of it. So it's both a joke and not a joke, but it's a joke because it's not a joke. I thought it was great, that bit.
But then, you know, and I talk about this in the book, because nobody... And it was unfortunate. It wasn't the BBC's fault, but the way they cut it, you know, they cut to him shaking the hands, and then the next time you saw him, he was looking down at his hands, putting the hand sanitizer on. So you didn't see the look that acknowledged, "I'm doing a bit
here."
But nobody thought that he was making a joke. So what you got online was an absolute avalanche of people just thinking this is fantastic. It's been confirmed to them that he's as big a dick as they think he is, and they express, as I quote quite a lot in the book, they express it in the most vile way, you know, and consider that he's this person who is, you know, despises the proletariat. And meanwhile, the people who defend him aren't defending him like, no, he was being funny. They're defending him like saying, well, it is good to be sanitary.
Reveal by Chris Heath about Robbie Williams is available now in shops, and it is highly, highly entertaining. But we better move on. Every week we ask our guest to bring in a tune to play on the show. She's brought in tea towels, old copies of Smash Hits, books by Chris.
So sorry.
She's gone full fangirl Partridge, but Nerdy Shireen's also brought in some music. What have you brought in for us?
I can't pronounce it.
Shall I say it for you?
Yeah, go on.
It's 10 Trix Point Never. Thanks. And the track is called The Pure and the Damned. Why have you chosen this record you can't pronounce?
Oh, I was just feeling really vulnerable and tired, and, you know, it is like, it's like, oh, who can we get that sounds like a wise old man? Iggy, just wheel him in. He's on everything at the minute, isn't he? Just kind of whining on, sounding comforting. So, it's a very beautiful bit of music.
Here's the beautiful, comforting, whining sounds of Iggy Pop with 10 Trix Point Never and The Pure and the Damned.
The pure always act from love. The damned always act from love. That's love. The pure always act from love. That's love.
10 Trix Point Never with The Pure and the Damned, featuring the voice of Iggy Pop, as chosen by Nadia Shireen. Iggy does all the collaborations, doesn't he?
New Order,
Norman Cook.
Queens
of the Stone Age. It's mandatory. He just hangs around in studios doing collabs. Okay, let's move on to a truly gigantic companion of pop promo videos entitled Power to the People, British Music Videos, 1966 to 2016. Compiled by a panel of video makers in collaboration with the BFI and containing 200 videos over 6 discs, this is as near to a time capsule of pop video as you're going to get. It's got everything on it, from The Who to FKA Twigs. Are we finally at the end of the video era, and is this a fitting headstone? We're going to find out after this, the track that accompanies the best British pop video of all time. This is True Faith by New Order. True Faith by New Order. Chris and Nadia are jumping up and down in brightly coloured pantaloons and slapping each other, while Matt is dressed as a deaf mute turtle lady and he's doing sign language.
None of that happened.
None of that happened. We had to parcel this stuff out because it's a huge
help
amount of
me,
stuff.
Somebody
Nadia,
help.
What did you make of your chunk of Power to the People?
So my chunk, I mean, I'm a complete, as we all are, I guess, you know, video nerd, you know, but my favourite thing was taping videos off the chart show, Top of the Pops, you know, I was like, yes, please, can we do this? I thought my selection was a bit odd, actually. There was,
who did you have?
I had a section that was called, now I can't remember the title exactly, but it was something like Comedy Classics.
Right.
So these, I presume, were videos that they thought were hilarious or like really, really funny. And in that collection was Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays.
Mm. Well, dry humour, I suppose.
I was like, really? Well, what, where are the lols here? Mm. Not really.
It's a sideways glance.
The mass murder thing didn't,
yeah,
didn't
I know.
Seem as funny.
I was like, I'm not finding this hilarious. It was an interesting collection. I feel like, were they maybe limited by which record companies providing
videos? Well, it's like the same
videos,
as all compilations, isn't it?
Guessing.
Who you can get the rights for.
Well, yeah. I mean, I found it pretty comprehensive. You know, I got the one that was labelled Performance. So I chose the boring one, bands playing in front of cameras.
Right.
I found it pretty comprehensive. It is quite a serious project, though, isn't it? It's a two-year collaboration between the University of Portsmouth and the University of the Arts London in partnership with the BFI, actually curated. What did you think, Chris? What was your...
Well, I made a weird discovery that I guess looking back has been true for a long time, but I genuinely wasn't aware of it until I started watching these discs. I really hate pop videos.
Do you? Why?
because they don't have what I love about pop music in them most of the time, and I realized, you know, I realized that even when there were songs that I loved, there were so few moments where I was enjoying watching the videos. I found it a complete trial watching them, which I
which
wasn't.
Which ones did you have?
I wasn't expecting. I had the first disc has, there is conceptual videos. There's one section of conceptual videos which have the group in partly, and one a pure conceptual. And I've no, it's not these categories. I have no problem with that category at all. There should be some great videos in that. And then I had a disc of dance videos, which I not dance music, but people, all kinds of different genres, but where people were doing some kind of dancing in. And I found them just incredibly annoying. Like even, you know, the only bit I enjoyed was like the first 30 seconds of True Faith. Even True Faith.
How can you not like True Faith?
It's one of the greatest songs ever written.
And it's one of the greatest videos ever made.
I find it really annoying. They're just that, you know, we all know the great bit is at the beginning where the percussion is done with the face slapping. That's a genuinely magical moment of music and imagery. I would say that's the only genuinely magical moment of music and imagery in those discs.
What
for
about
me.
The bouncing, when they're bouncing in the big suits?
Really, I don't really care. I mean, it was great
now
to see.
And now that you get every kid's party you go to, they've got those sumo things. It's kind of like a little bit less special.
Well, I was watching. I watched the chunk that I had included the single take Massive Attack Unfinished Sympathy video, which is one big long magical moment. Yeah. You've Sharon Nelson walking a single street in Los Angeles. In the background, you can see life is going on while she sings.
No, I agree with that.
Great song. Yeah. Absolutely beautiful. But also, I mean, in the set, there's things like, you know, more recent ones. Like there's a lot of Chemical Brothers here for some reason, possibly because the Chemical Brothers are very...
I had some too.
I had some too.
Patrons of the Arts. A great dance video for Wake Up, the recent one, which kind of, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, in which a ballet dancer slowly...
Oh, Wide Open.
So it slowly becomes... you know, parts of her body are replaced by...
That was on my disc too.
Oh, well, I flipped through them all. Letting in light on magic here. You know, and
being a professional.
There's another fantastic Chemical Brothers one. I think it's Electro Bank, where a man is pursued around London by the machines that build cars, which have come alive and are chasing him. Is he on drugs or is it really happening? That one of those kind of things. And I think, you know.
Or is it an outtake from Transformers?
Well, kind of, yeah. And I think, you know, what this set sort of demonstrates is that, you know, music videos started off as let's point a camera at the Rolling Stones in a foam bath playing, you know, It's Only Rock and Roll Dressed as Sailors because that's funny. And it evolves into this kind of playpen for film directors to kind of spend a lot of money, go crazy, create some astonishing images without having to bother about the tedium of narrative, which I find quite valuable and enjoyable.
Well, it's been a great playpen for people to learn cinema, but I mean, let's not forget there's some weird economics at work here. That for 20 years or whatever it was, a huge part of every art, music artist's budget on a record was to make 3 or 4 videos per album, huge amounts of money at the peak of it. And most of these things are things that are completely forgotten. It's absolutely wasted money and artistically worthless stuff. And you just did it because you had to do it. And
hated it, yeah.
Well, because they were like, why are we doing it? And you had to do it because if you didn't do it, you weren't seriously releasing a record.
But isn't that what the aim of this project is, to find the 5% of that stuff that isn't artistically worthless, that is really interesting? I think it broadly succeeds, actually.
I just had the feeling of, if this is the best.
Well, I think it's also, that project, you know, the 5% of it that's pure art, but it's also an epitaph because this stuff doesn't get made anymore. And the reason it doesn't get made anymore is partly, as Chris said, because the economics are just insane, but it's partly because there isn't an outlet for it.
Yeah.
And there isn't an audience for it, because the audience are not going to... The audience that, when we were kind of in our teens and watching the chart show on Saturday morning and stuff, was that kind of teenage audience. The teenage audience doesn't watch videos on a large screen anymore. They watch videos on their phone, and there's no point doing a kind of filmic... You know, if you try to watch Unfinished Sympathy or the Verve track... Something with a load of background detail, loads of stuff going on a phone, your eyes would cross and you would go mental.
However, video streaming video is absolutely enormous and is still a huge part of what drives pop. But what you've got now is you've got things like the lyric video, which is the cheapo video. You've got the creativity has been so marketing driven in that every genre has its style of video.
Well, you've also got that SBTV thing where you've got, you know, a vast majority of kind of people come up through kind of the grime and black music scenes by just essentially filming a video on their phone with their mates in the local car park.
One of the best videos.
And they're brilliant.
One of the best ones in this is The Streets, Fit But You Know It, Fit But Don't You Know It, in which, you know, Mike Skinner goes and collects his photographs from Snappy Snaps and the action takes place in the photographs. And it's a great amount of money and humour and creativity poured into making something look grimy and photoreal. And what you just described is things being grimy and photoreal for nothing on your iPhone.
It's slightly different to that, but a little, a neat kind of line that I noticed was I had kind of house music-y type section. So you had the Happy Mondays with, what was the song? Anyway, it's just them gurning about in a club. But, you know, you kind of, feel like...
You haven't narrowed it down.
No. But, you know, you're like, okay, I'm here. I'm gurning about in a club with Happy Mondays. This is quite fun. And then you had Flowered Up Weekender, which, my gosh, was like, quite bleak, the whole 20 minutes of it. And then you've got a few more, including a Streets one where he's at a wedding and he's taking an E, and I was feeling quite ill watching it, I have to be honest. Like, it was like, oh, I never want to go out again. The horrible video for Smack My Bitch Up by The Prodigy, which I just despise. And then you have the video by Chase and Status, which is, have you seen it? It's like Flowered Up Weekender, except it was filmed about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And what's it called?
Is it an Avenit video?
It's an Avenit video.
A record of Avenit.
It's an Avenit video, but as if they kind of do the Shane Meadows thing, this is England type thing. So it looks like it was filmed in 1988, but actually it was filmed three or four years ago. And it's kind of more successful than the Flowered Up video at kind of giving you that weekend rave experience.
I think the Flowered Up video was kind of, you know, everyone, it was massive, wasn't it, when it came out? And it was kind of like people trading VHS copies, and then and it was because it was that kind of the first attempt that anyone had made to sum it up seriously.
Massive, this massive club night happens in like Trafalgar Square or something in the Flowered Up video. Yeah. Like, really,
Chris? I want to ask you. I mean, you're basically advancing the argument that music is for listening to, not looking at.
No. Just to be clear, I'm not averse to looking at. Mm. And you know, and obviously, I love it when music and visual imagery comes together. And I look at the people I like. You know, it's like the Pet Shop Boys. You know, their tours, everything. You know, it's like
this box for some reason.
No, well, I don't know why.
Odd.
I love it when it works. I guess what I'm saying, I'm not criticizing the possibility of it working. I'm criticizing the strike rate, you know, and it's pitifully small is what I'm seeing from this in my judgment. And maybe it's a harsh judgment, but it's a real judgment that, you know, I was kind of looking forward to this. Mm. And so it's kind of shocking to me how little I enjoyed it.
Well, how much were was the video identity of a band, how central was that to the way that Smash Hits would assess people as suitable prospects?
Not as much as maybe people would think. It was just, you know, we were on one hand obsessive about the music. I mean, for us, it was like getting the white label of someone we were interested in, and we'd all play it on the office stereo. And if we all liked it, it would get played again and again that day. And we were really good at judging whether something was going to connect, and we were really excited. Now, so then a video, just like a photo, just like anything else, would go into that assessment. So, you know, something like the video for Take On Me by A-ha, you realize suddenly that's a thing, mm-hmm. and that has defined the way a group is, and made them seem much more interesting. But We weren't, you know, we weren't that, you know, wasn't a big focus.
This box set, Powers of the People, British Music Video 1966 to 2016. I've got to say, I enjoyed my slice of it. I mean, it's interesting to see the kind of vast gulf between what the song is and how an unrelated director often interprets it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's everything here from great stuff like Window Licker by Aphex Twin, which is just truly astonishing piece of work, and all of those Chemical Brothers videos. I'm surprised that Madness aren't on there, because that, to me, is the most British music video genre of all.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether it's because it wasn't directory enough, you know, not auteur-y enough, insufficiently filmic, cinematic.
There must have been some limitations to what they could choose, yep, but I presume. But I was really, I enjoyed it, but I was really depressed as well, because I had the really hard-hitting disc of, you know, difficult videos, which, yeah, included MIA's video, where she, it's the kind of recreation of some kind of horrible civil war.
The kind of Intifada one, where...
It's white ginger boys and men being blown up and killed, and it's extremely graphic and horrendous.
Is it Think About It? Think
About It, yeah. I had the Think About It, yeah, disc.
I'm sorry about that. I won't talk to Think About It.
I'm so depressed.
I'm just happy with Godley and Cream
so
doing
I had
cry.
U2's Think About It, yeah, video about Northern Ireland.
Right.
Where, like, some people fall in love and then one of them gets blown up. And, MIA.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Sorry. MIA, the blown up gin. Just lots of people getting blown up. And I was like, really? Oh.
I can guarantee you, listeners, some of it's more fun than that. But it's only 40 quid for six discs. That's 20p a video. It used to be 50p a go at the alt pub video jukebox.
Just watch them on YouTube. Why wouldn't you just watch them on YouTube for free?
Because these are nicely remastered on a big screen. Okay, let's have some more music. Chris Heath, what have you brought in as your choice for the show?
I brought in this song by the Chromatics, which I think it originally came out a couple of years ago, but I only found it when it was one of the songs at the end of one of the episodes of the new Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. I just think it's an amazing song. I was amazed I didn't know about it.
Okay, well, let's have a listen. This is Shadow by the Chromatics. Shadow by the Chromatics from the Twin Peaks soundtrack. Did you understand any of Twin Peaks, Chris? Or was it just like watching the Turner Prize?
You know, I was watching it because I was writing about Carl McLaughlin. So it was sort of, it was, you know, it's something that I needed to watch. But I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. Because I was a bit daunted by the idea of, I thought I might be kind of annoyed by it. It's some of the weirdest TV that you can still see, which I was amazed in 2017 that it could be that unusual. Mm. But there's some amazingly, really grippingly weird moments and ungrippingly weird moments. Like there's these fantastic moments where suddenly nothing happens for forever.
That's on the sticker on the DVD. Actually.
There's an amazing scene in the middle of like episode 7 or something where it cuts to the Roadhouse bar. And you know this kind of scene. There's someone sweeping and there's a guy about to answer the phone and say something. And then the phone doesn't ring. It's a fixed camera. The guy's sweeping. And he sweeps for like 3 minutes. And it's just a fixed camera. And you watch this guy sweep the floor. Nothing funny happens. And you think, is it a joke? Is this? And then eventually the phone rings and the kind of thing you expect to do with the plot happens. And it carries on. And that sounds like that could be really annoying or really pointless or really pretentious. And I have to say, watching it, I thought it was magical.
Did you watch the original?
Yeah. Right.
Loads happened in the original.
Loads of stuff happened.
Anyway, we're going to crack on. Our third topic of the day is a movie about the worst movie ever made. The Disaster Artist is the semi-fictionalised story of The Room, a legendarily bad early noughties independent movie which became a cult hit by dint of its very dreadfulness. James Franco directs and plays Tommy Wiseau, who, if he were not real, would rank as one of the oddest creations in cinema. Franco's brother Dave plays Wiseau's friend, aspiring actor Greg, who's roped into making the most nonsensical passion project imaginable. Is The Disaster Artist a snide freak show or an honest tribute to outsider art? Let's have a taster.
So there's this guy, Johnny, a true American hero, to be played by me. He has it all. Good luck, many friends, and also maybe Johnny is vampire. We'll see.
This set of the alleyway looks exactly like the real alleyway.
That's right.
Well, why don't we just shoot in the real alleyway?
Because it's a real Hollywood movie.
No, yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
Action!
I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
What the f- it doesn't work if you're looking at the camera.
And then this beautiful girl, anything for my princess, she betrayed him.
And then this guy, Johnny.
He go crazy. Nobody respect my vision.
You are a villain.
I do this whole movie for you, Greg. You are tearing me apart, Lisa.
That was James Franco and associates in The Disaster Artist. Nadia Shireen.
Yeah.
Is The Disaster Artist a snide freak show or an honest portrait of outsider art?
I don't think it's snide. I think it's a pretty affectionate, a pretty indulgent look at this guy. I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, Tommy Wiseau, what a character. I was trying to think, who does he remind me of? And all I could come up with was Nuno from Extreme, crossed with, you know, the inspector in Hello, Hello, who's like bemoaning. If you don't cross those two, that's who I ended up with.
Just set it up for us. Tell us what happens here and why we're watching it.
So we're watching it because Tommy Wiseau is this fantasist with this bottomless pit of money who is rejected by Hollywood and decides to write, direct, create and star in his own film, which is called The Room, which actually happened. And The Room is a film which has become a cult favourite for being the worst film ever made. Basically, it's kind of Ed Wood, right? Mm. And The Room is his Plan 9 from outer space. Except I think The Room's like really worse. I've not seen The Room. This really made me to go and watch Tommy's actual film, The Room. So this this film, The Disaster Artist, is looking at the making of The Room through the eyes of Greg, who was Tommy's cohort and who starred in it with him. I mean, I really enjoyed it. It is really indulgent. And I was saying to a friend last night, you know, Tommy's a bit of a monster. At points, he's really unlikable, I think. Despite the fact he's quite unlikable, we're meant to kind of admire his ambition and his romantic desire for adulation. And I was like, well, why? Why are we constantly meant to kind of push aside all this stuff just to admire a man's ambition? And I'm sorry to be the chick in the room, but I was like, would we ever do this for a woman?
it's an interesting thought. I mean, to me, the reason it's kind of compelling is that it's affectionate towards someone who has absolutely everything you could possibly need to make it in Hollywood. Belief, you know, mad drive, absolutely everything except talent.
Yeah.
He is utterly talentless. Oh, and by the way, he's got a very weird voice, and we never quite understand why he's got a very weird voice. And there's something to me that, I mean, there's something, it's clearly intended to direct you towards the idea that there's something heroic about wanting to do it so badly, even though you plainly cannot.
I don't want to. I kind of resent being asked to admire that a little bit.
Hmm. Chris, what are you?
Firstly, I love the movie. I thought I was expecting to find it a bit annoying because I knew all about The Room. And I've had no desire ever to see it. I found the idea of liking that a bit annoying, and I thought this movie would be like that too. But I loved it. I don't feel like you. One of the things I liked is I don't feel the movie does demand that you are totally on board with him or empathize with him. Mm. He has a triumph potentially, you know, against the odds, but I don't think you have to feel like you're alongside him for that triumph. I think you're still looking in from the outside at that and knowing what a messed up person he is. Mm. And the fact that the film doesn't blunt any of that and that you keep seeing it all the way through, I think, is probably one of its strengths.
I sort of came out of it thinking there are worse things to be than a manipulative madman with no self-awareness or talent.
Well, that's a very 2017 point
of view. It made me feel it was affectionate enough and loving enough to make me feel charitable towards, as you absolutely correctly say, a guy who's a monster, and I'm not sure we would accept this. I'm not sure if a woman could even get into the place that Tommy Wiseau was in, because he's a walking caricature, isn't he? You're right.
He is. I guess that's the only niddle I had. I mean, I did, you know, I didn't like hate him at all, but I suppose... I felt a bit weary. It was a little bit like, oh, I suppose we need to indulge this again. You know, it's like we're asked to indulge him. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, must we?
But Hollywood does love making films about Hollywood, doesn't it? Whether it's kind of like, you know, the silent movie one with the dog. You mentioned Ed Wood, you know, well,
this
extras.
This is basically La La Land.
Even La La Land,
It's La La Land without the jazz, the songs, the talent, or the women. Imagine if the music business had a large chunk of albums just about producers and engineers and what monsters and nutcases they were. Yeah. This is my new album. It's about another album about a crazy producer.
It's in the Jim Steinman section at in your local record store.
I started to watch last night clips of The Room on YouTube because I was like, I really want to see The Room now. And I couldn't make it past the first, I think I watched about 3 minutes, and then I'm like, I can't do this. I've tried hate watching before. I've watched Bullet Quo, the status quo film.
Can I say why?
Oh, just for the challenge of it. Like, someone had a DVD and I was like, yeah, all right, let's watch it. And
I used to listen to the UK subs like that.
The hate listen. We should do it. We should do a bit on the show eventually, one of these days, about hate watching and pity watching. I pity watched the Fantastic Four movie and wish I hadn't. I hate watched Gigli with
Ben Affleck.
Baffleck and the other one. And genuinely unspeakable. Not to the extent that 15 minutes in you're thinking, well, you know, this is not fun or entertaining. What is the bloody point?
I tried to rewatch Peter's Friends recently. Yeah. I couldn't get past the opening scene, which I don't know if any listeners remember the opening scene.
Absolutely not.
It's Emma Thompson, Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, Kenneth Branagh doing a review show.
Didn't we get that for free on the BBC for years and years and years?
Yeah. But anyway, I've got no time to hate watch, so I couldn't watch any more of The Room.
Fair dues. The Disaster Artist is out now, and you can fully enjoy it without having seen The Room.
Yeah,
God knows
absolutely.
I didn't. Yeah.
Oh, I think it's wiser.
Yeah, okay. And that's very nearly the end of our show, which means it is time for our guests to tell us their closing time chatter. What will they be talking about as they are asked to drink up and leave the pop-up artisan gin shacks and tap rooms of wherever they happen to be this weekend? Nadia, what have you got for us?
Well, I'm trying to, you know, make things a little bit cuddlier on this podcast because it's all so hard-nosed. So considering my job title as children's picture book person, I wanted to talk about bears, fictional bears, because Paddington is, you know, he's got the top... I was chatting with, so we were like, who's the top bear? Who's top fictional bear at the moment? Mm. And it is Paddington because Michael Bond, God rest his soul, you know, recently passed away, and the movie is, you know, Paddington 2's Top of the Pops. But there's a Winnie the Pooh exhibition that's just opened at the V&A this week. So now Paddington's being challenged.
The Eight Shepherd.
Yeah, yeah. So I was just, you know, thinking about bears, basically.
So it's a bear clash.
Rupert raises his little nose around this time of year. I'm personally not a huge Rupert fan.
Why do these things sort of bubble to the surface and the kind of, you know, the rhythms of kids' pop culture? For some reason, you know, in the mid-noughties, pirates became a thing. Even before Pirates of the Caribbean, just pirates were a thing.
I don't know. I think they just become a thing, and then they're safe places to go. Did pirates become a thing?
Pirates was a huge thing in the mid-noughties. I know this because that's when all my mates had kids.
Right, okay. Pirates. Well, things like Paddington and Winnie the Pooh are...
That makes it sound like it was the events followed each other naturally. There were loads of pirates and all your mates have kids.
Could well be. Who knows?
that might be it. Yes. I don't know. So I was just interested to know, you know, favourite fictional bear, anyone? I mean, we can go...
Fictional bear. Chewbacca doesn't count, does it?
No, he's not a bear.
Original Bungle on Rainbow.
No, he's
fearful.
Evil.
Fear Bungle, which is... He looks like the Krampus or something.
It's kind of like... Mine would be... Is it too dark to say Shardik? Adams.
I don't even know.
Richard Adams' book about a bear.
Or would it?
But it wasn't very cuddly, I seem to remember.
Or would it be better to say Shaco, the only bear on the CIA death list from 2000 AD?
What?
The polar bear. Basically, they just...
You try and be cuddly.
Look what happens.
We need to do Jaws, but can we do it at the South Pole with a bear instead? And they did, and it was amazing.
Really?
But I mean, if you sort of posted it, said the only bear on the CIA death list, you'd go and see it. It wouldn't be Paddington.
No, okay, wow.
Fair enough. Chris Heath, what's your closing time chatter? Follow that.
I want to know whose favourite bear is.
You don't want to know anything about my bears?
Let's see your favourite bear.
I wasn't thinking of a fictional one. I immediately thought of Werner Herzog listening with the headphones on in Grizzly Man.
It's ripped apart.
Right. Exactly. And I'm thinking of that bear you never see.
Absolutely. So that will fit in well with Paddington 2. Let's have your closing.
Sorry.
Let's have your closing time chatter.
I'm all up all the time. So of course it's something I find annoying. I think I was looking through my iTunes and realizing just how ludicrously much I listen to, because they've just come out, some 35th anniversary, some 40th anniversary, some 27th anniversary thing. And I dutifully listen to these things. And it just struck me that ever since albums like this have been reissued with extra things, I think you could make a list about 3 songs long of all the amazing songs that have been discovered from the dustbin of history that didn't come out at the time. Mm. And I mean, you know, half of what's released now is this. Yeah. And I just want to know if anyone can argue against that.
No, I never listen to the extras on a reissue. It's like, what's the point?
I do actually.
I listen to them all. I'm the idiot. I'm like listening. I still have the hope. That's the thing. That's what I'm really talking about. You know,
there are things that are one listen job. But it's like, oh well, here's the demo. It's a bit different. The lyrics are slightly different. It's not quite as well recorded.
Yeah.
But I mean, close to home, the Pet Shop Boys, with their recent reissues. Often those demos are very, very different. There's a demo of vocal. Which is a completely different song.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. No, demos are different. I think it's very rare that you end up going, I really prefer the demo too. But that's an interesting way of like rediscussing in your mind something that you really love. That's I think's worthwhile. But it's actually like, you know, magical songs that got lost.
One of the biggest, I mean, I suppose it's not quite what you're saying, but one of the biggest discoveries for me recently, and this is embarrassing, it's only a recent discovery, but you know the Prefab Sprout album, Steve McQueen, when that was reissued in 2002 or 2003, I think he did an extra
acoustic.
Acoustic disc, and I've been obsessed with that kind of all year listening to that, which is, I suppose, a complete reinterpretation.
The weird thing about that acoustic disc, because I read him talking about it, is that it sounds like, you know, they're like, can you do something extra? And he went in the studio for the afternoon and did it. And I read that it took him a year.
Well, that sounds very Paddy McAleer.
Yeah.
What I want to know, though, is, you know, it's all well and good doing an acoustic version of a big production album, but why doesn't somebody get, you know, why doesn't somebody get Nick Drake's, you know, Pink Moon or something, and the additional disc is a full Trevor Horn mega pop reinterpretation, drum machines, orchestras, bangers. Do it the other way around. The idea that acoustic is always an improvement, I stand against that.
The John Lewisification
of everything. Yeah. You know, let's turn these things into bangers.
Good idea,
Matt. What have you got?
Paul Scholes was a pundit on a football program earlier this week, He spent the whole of his career not saying anything on purpose very interesting, but has now developed a kind of quite an interesting line in dry Mancunian wit. And when the Gary Lineker was trying to hype up BT Sports coverage of the Manchester Derby this coming weekend, Scholes came out with the classic line, "It's a big game." I'm not going to do the accent, but think of this in a kind of flat Mancunian accent. "It's a big game, but it's not that big. Don't know what all the fuss is about. United will always be the number one club in Manchester. The Hacienda's probably still second, and it's been closed 20 years." which I just thought, you know, how way to talk down your employer's big selling game at the weekend, Paul.
I'm going to give that a gigantic there. Paul Scholes. Well, my closing time chatter is I'm going to attack science. There's a survey. All of it. A survey has come out. Science, this is in inc.com, inc.com. "Science, listening to this type of music makes you a better person. Want to be more generous, empathetic and cooperative? Put on these particular tunes." And it's a very, very thin piece of research which claims that uplifting anthems make people nicer. From Michael Jackson's "Heal the World" to the Black Eyed Peas' "Where Is the Love?" We all love to belt out uplifting anthems. It'll make us a better person. Flatly contradicted by my experience. People who like that kind of music are not nicer at all. "Lyrics can bust your bias." Well, you know, if it takes Bruno Mars's "Count on Me" to make you reject racism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry, God help you. But the one that really got me was we have scientifically proven, according to this tendentious survey, that moving to the beat makes people more cooperative. If you listen to dance-related rhythmic music, it makes you work together and behave in a more cooperative manner. As somebody who has edited Mixmag, I can tell you that is absolutely untrue.
Well, is that science piece done by, what's the Daily Mash's Institute of Everything?
Institute of Studies.
I think, you know,
Brainy Boffins at the Institute of Studies. But what got me about this was the idea that the purpose of music is to be therapeutic, that the job of music is to make you a better person. I don't think it is at all. The job of music is to be music.
Quite the opposite.
Yeah, the job of music is to just be itself and to spark whatever else, whatever it can in your head, good, bad, or indifferent. And the idea that the idea that art is therapeutic, the idea that we should only watch things to make us better people.
Or even useful.
Yeah.
I don't want art. If art's accidentally useful, great. But God, please don't make it its purpose.
I remember Andy Peebles once on the radio asking somebody, often.
Sorry, you were bound to tell an Andy Peebles anecdote.
It's all white hot stuff on Big Mouth.
It's like a time warp.
White hot. I remember Andy Peebles asking somebody. I can't remember.
It's demographic of the show.
Do you use music at all? Do you use music? And I thought, well, as what? To drown out the sound of the bin lorries? Or to, you know, to block things out? Do you use... No, you don't use music. You let the music use you.
Oh.
Is what you do.
Oh.
And on that hands in the air moment, that's the end of our show. Thank you to our guest, Chris Heath, whose reveal featuring starring Robbie Williams is available now in bookshops. What are you up to next, Chris?
I'm writing a book about something so incredibly different that you wouldn't believe.
Gary Barlow.
What is it, or are you not at liberty to reveal?
I'm not at liberty, but it's nothing to do with popular culture.
Ah,
at
okay.
all. Time will tell.
Okay, fair dues. And thank you to Nadia Shireen for coming in and for bringing her entire Smash Hits collection and portable partridge room with her. What are you up to next? More monkeys?
Next picture book is out in May, which is called Billy and the Beast. And apart from that, just wandering around stalls drawing bears for children.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for both coming in. Please do come in again. You're welcome at any time. Remember, dear listener, you can hear this show and all of our old episodes again at audioboom.com/channel/bigmouth. Thanks for listening, and we will see you again next week.